Stay tuned for Writers on Writing coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
A song through its doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. Love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day.
Listening information for all KUCI 88.9 FM radio frequency and KUCI.org broadband recipients. Weekly signals with Mike Kaspar and Nathan Callahan, a one-hour irreverent reality-based mashup of contemporary events, commentary and interviews, broadcasts every Tuesday beginning at 8 a.m. sharp. You may choose to listen to Weekly Signals Weekly Review, Seymour Hersh, Garrison Keillor, Terry Jones and Ariana Huffington, to name a few, demand online at weeklysignals.com or live during the Weekly Signals Tuesday morning 8 a.m. time slot. However you choose, your listening is required. Again, that's KUCI Weekly Signals Tuesdays 8 a.m. and so on.
Yeah, the dirt on publishing, writers, authors, all of it. Listen.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at KUCI.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good morning and welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at KUCI.org and always available via podcast. I'm your host, Marie Stone. As always, Writers on Writing brings you live conversations with authors, poets, agents, and publishers. I'm joined now by D.T. Max, and coming up in the second half hour, Sahir Alam will be with me talking about her latest novel, The Groom to Have Been. D.T. Max's essays, reviews, and reporting on literature, culture, and science have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times Magazine, The Los Angeles Times, The Wall Street Journal, The San Francisco Chronicle, and The Chicago Tribune. His work has been anthologized in The Best American Science Writing 2006 and elsewhere. His latest medical mystery is The Family That Couldn't Sleep. It is as terrifying as any science fiction novel, perhaps more so because it's 100% true. It's published by Random House, it's widely available in bookstores and online, and it's the subject of our discussion this morning. DT, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. I know this is not an easy time for you, so I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I want to spend the first part of our time together talking about the book, these curious things called prions and the havoc they can cause and potentially spread, when good prions go bad discussion and what that can look like.
Right.
And I suppose that conversation could go on for days, but I also hope to leave time and for a general discussion of your wonderful ability to impart complicated information in entertaining ways and your craft of approaching nonfiction with a fiction writer style and gift with language. So that's not too much to ask of, 30 minutes. So.
Thank you.
So let's start with a general introduction to the book and the subject matter. Can you kind of give us a bird's eye overview of The Family That Couldn't Sleep?
Yeah, sure. It's a true story about an Italian family who for 200 years have had a fatal insomnia. And the insomnia comes on them in their 50s. During the early part of their lives, they lead normal lives. They live and they love and they marry and they do all the things the rest of us do and worry about their bills and have big Christmas dinners together and so on. And then in their 50s, they suddenly develop a fatal, quickly progressive insomnia. And the first symptom is that they, it's actually not that they can't sleep, but they begin to sweat uncontrollably. And then their pupils become these tiny pinpricks. And that's when members in the family obviously know by now what's going on. They understand, what's about to happen to them. And then fairly quickly they begin to lose the ability to nap and then to sleep at all, sleep deeply at night, and then finally to sleep at all. And then the disease, which is certainly one of the worst we know of, leads inexorably to death in about 6 months usually.
Mm. And that's just one of the ways these prions manifest themselves. They come in kind of a variety of forms, and there were a number of different diseases that you talked about that...
Right, yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the fatal insomnia, which is the name of this disease that the Italian family has, is what's called a prion disease, and prions are very strange diseases because they're not bacteria and they're not viruses, and if you remember anything at all about high school science, you remember that diseases are usually bacteria or virus. In other words, they're things that are sort of living. And what's odd about prion diseases is that they're protein diseases, which means proteins are the things that make up your hair, your skin, and proteins aren't supposed to cause diseases. So the fact that they can do so, as in the case of fatal familial insomnia, has led to a lot of really interesting medical discoveries. I mean, the disease has been a real treasure trove for researchers.
Yeah, in fact, I think there was a study that came out maybe it was last week or two weeks ago by Harvard talking about Alzheimer's and a connection with proteins. And, the proteins are sort of turned gunky or I can't remember the...
That's exactly right. Gunky, yep.
I'm sure that sounds like a Harvard word. They turned gunky.
Well, I mean, what's interesting about these diseases, protein diseases in general, is that you have it exactly right. They're physical diseases, so... You can use words like gunky or misformed when you talk about what causes the disease. So, for instance, in the case of fatal familial insomnia, a first protein misforms, and then rather quickly it causes other proteins to misform within the body. And so you get kind of a chain reaction, very much like a chemical chain reaction. And that's the actual cause of fatal familial insomnia. It's nothing very complicated. It's not as complicated as viruses or bacteria. But, the result in the family is what's sort of distinctive and strange, and that the result is that they have this, this really chronic and remarkable inability to sleep. I mean, a really noteworthy and sudden onset. And, it's always been thought that nobody dies from lack of sleep. I mean, when I was first researching this story, that was the first thing I was told was, that's impossible. No one dies from lack of sleep. But in fact, in the case of the family, that is really what they die of. They actually die of an insomnia.
That's amazing. Now, you've been fairly open about your own experiences with a neurodegenerative disease. Did that stimulate your interest in this particular subject matter, or was that, just kind of something that existed alongside of your research?
Well, no, I mean, I think, you know, I think I have a sort of unknown and seems sort of unknowable condition that causes a chronic weakening of the legs. And so, sure, it absolutely opens you up to questions about disease and health in a way that's probably not typical. I mean, I began the book, I was 40, and, you know, this would not have been the typical first subject of my study. You know, I think there's no question, you know, I think there's a phrase in the book about from Wallace Stevens, the poet Wallace Stevens, about something like the residents of the rain are rainy men. I've got that slightly wrong, and Wallace Stevens lovers will kill me for it, but but it's close. Anyway, you know, well, we're all rainy men, or rainy men and women. That's one of the kind of ideas behind the family that couldn't sleep, is that, you know, sure, it's a thunderstorm where this family in Italy is concerned, but, you know, the condition of illness is universal, and every family knows, you know, what it is to have somebody in the family who's sick. And so absolutely there's a connection, without a doubt.
Yeah. They, you know, one of the scary things about this is the immortal quality of these proteins. Unlike bacteria or something, you can't boil these or disinfect, or there's really nothing you can do. And in fact, you were talking about how these things live in the soil for up to, you know, 10, probably longer years.
That's right.
There's really no way to get rid of them.
No, I mean, what's really interesting about prions from a medical point of view, or a protein, a disease caused by a protein, remember proteins, the things in our body, like skin and hair, is because they're not dead, not living, you can't kill them.
Right.
So you get the very intriguing medical question, well, how do you deal with a disease that you cannot kill? How do you deal with essentially an immortal disease agent? And the answer is, well, it's a complicated answer, but the easiest thing is that you can bleach it. Unfortunately, bleach doesn't really work in the body.
Right. Has other unfortunate side effects. You know, the other great thing about this book is that it covers so much material. You've got these curious Nobel scientists. There are principally two of them. One is a self-described pedagogic pedophiliac pediatrician.
Can't say that five times. Definition.
By his own, yeah. By and then you've got you know, these, you know, it's kind of a thing driven by greed and driven by just a lot of curious things. I'm wondering if, are you still there?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Strange.
That's you with me. I'm sorry. I didn't.
No, not at all. There's.
I don't know.
I'm wondering if there is, if these people would have emerged kind of, I'm sorry, I've lost my train of thought.
Whoever's walking in the background.
Probably a prion. Anyway, of course, there are these men who have presented themselves to you as who they really are. I'm wondering if their story would have been as integral to the book had they not had the quirks they had, or if they would have more faded into the background and been boring smart scientists.
Well, I mean, I think it may be the subject for the second part of our discussion, which is about writing and how you write about these sorts of things. But in brief, yeah, of course. I mean, you know, writing exists about people fundamentally. So my writing exists to be about people. And so, you know, the fact that these guys were so human and so flawed. There's Carlton Gottschalk, won the Nobel Prize in 1976. He's the pedophile pedagogic fellow you discussed. And, you know, I mean, he is just extraordinary to write about. And then there's Stanley Prusiner, won the Nobel Prize, again, for prion research in 1997. And, you know, he's a man who I think is perfectly designed for modern science with the need to raise money and raise publicity and get people like me interested in your subject. So, yeah, we're a long way from the era of the gray scientist in this book. And I think it does help. I mean, it helps the book. I think it helps the reader.
Yeah, it was, you know, between that and there are discussions of cannibalism, there are discussions of mad cow disease. I was reading this as I was, you know, cooking a beef dinner, thinking this is probably not the greatest idea. The other theme that kind of came through in this is how we're perhaps bringing about our own destruction by our own greed, and the kind of the little consideration we give to technology, or, you know, you talked in the book about these genetically manufactured cows and how
right.
we've created or kind of tinkered with the structure of cows and sheep in order to make them more profitable. And
yeah, I think that's right. No, I mean, we've definitely pushed. Well, I would not say that fatal familial insomnia is a problem of our making, but certainly mad cow disease, which is a closely related disease, is a problem of our making, of trying to force cows to give us more milk and more beef than they would normally give. I mean, it's been part of a 200-year-long kind of eugenics process where we've been trying to give ourselves, you know, enough food, enough milk at the lowest possible price. I mean, these are issues that come up in other stories besides prions, but they're very central to the prion story. And the result was mad cow disease. And if you read the papers today, mad cow disease, although it's not all that much on the minds of Americans, is basically bringing down the government of South Korea right now. It's extraordinary, strange reality. And the book, in fact, is published in South Korea, which I find kind of, you know, I didn't know what they were interested in when they bought it, but I guess I thought, well, insomnia is a universal worry. And Koreans probably have as much in trouble with insomnia as we do. And then, of course, it turned out that this book landed right in the middle of a sort of political firestorm.
Amazing. Is there a concern about the weaponization of prions?
You know, I think there is, and it's probably not very well founded. And I think the reason is that although they'd be terrific weapon agents because they're unstoppable, they're lousy weapon agents because they're almost, you know, it takes so much technology to handle them, to purify a prion is extremely, extremely difficult. A Canadian fellow did write a novel in which prions were deliberately encased in the beef casings of pills in the Muslim. I forget the exact details, and maybe it was in the Muslim world or something. And so it was used as a kind of equivalent of a smallpox vector or disease, a deliberate introduction of disease into. But anyway, it was fantasy, and I think. Pretty quickly, I'm looking at it, you can see. I mean, what's really interesting about prions is that they're really cutting-edge science. I mean, they're really, it takes tens of millions of dollars to have a lab where you can do any work on the prion. It's not, you know, if you really wanted to cause disease, there are a lot easier ways to do it.
Right. I should also give you an opportunity to talk about some of the different other ways that this has manifested itself. We've talked about mad cow, and we've talked about FFI, this familial insomnia.
Right.
But there were some other curious experiences you had, and one that you kind of personally witnessed with the deer, and I just thought maybe you could mention some of those.
Yeah. Well, America does have its own homegrown prion disease, and it's quite severe, and it's called chronic wasting disease, and you find it primarily in areas like Colorado. I don't know that California has it. I wouldn't be surprised. Colorado has it, Montana has it, and it's spread more east than west. But it's basically very similar to mad cow disease. These deer are somehow spreading prions to each other, contaminated prions, misformed prions, which are causing symptoms like, you know, extreme weight loss, and then they become kind of unstable on their legs, and then they die. No one's ever really established whether the deer meat in turn, which people do eat, although they don't eat a ton of it compared to cows, whether that's dangerous for people to consume. And there have been a number of scares in the Rocky Mountain states involving, you know, there was supposedly a cluster of people who seemed to have some sort of prion disease, and they were all joined by the fact that they had all eaten at deer feasts. I think they're described as hunter feasts in Colorado. But, you know, none of this has ever really panned out. But, again, I mean, I don't think one could say never.
Right.
And when you look at the situation in South Korea, I think emotion plays a huge role in fear about prion diseases. And I think, actually, that's one reason the book sort of struck a chord, was because although you sort of have two things people fear very much, you have insomnia, which is certainly awful enough, and then you have this unstoppable, immortal agent, you know, this agent you can't kill because it was never alive, called the prion. So you have a pretty tough pair. You know, this family was dealt a pretty tough hand.
Yeah, the other thing that was interesting to me about this family is how, and I guess this also kind of plays into our discussion of how you wrote the book, but this family is fairly closed about talking about it, even amongst themselves. There's kind of a sense of either denial or, you know, not wanting to kind of dwell on doom or something, but they're fairly closed about talking about
it. Yeah, I think they go in waves, and I think they're much more open than they were. But for the 200 years that the disease, you know, struck, going back as far as we know to the sort of mid 18th century, you know, yeah, they were really, they did not talk about it even among themselves. It was just a family disease. And then I think in more recent years they became more open about it, and they saw the possibility of that, you know, they couldn't get the doctors they needed without talking about their disease. They couldn't get the world's experts. They couldn't get the prisoners and the Gaidasheks to pay attention to them if they continued to treat it as a complete family secret. So as they've learned about fatal familial insomnia, you know, they become more open about it and made themselves available sort of not all the time, but sometimes to talk about it and talk about the family's experiences. I think always worried, you know, that it's just going to be kind of exploited, but always hopeful that it's going to result in some gain for them.
Right. And they have all been tested, so they have elected, most of them have elected not to know whether or not they carry the protein?
Well, actually, the story is a little bit different than that. What's actually happened is that they've been tested, but under the Italian rules, they're not allowed to know whether they have the gene or not.
Oh, interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, so it's not that they have chosen, although I think many would choose it anyway, but they're simply not able to. They're simply not being told.
Right. Interesting. I want to shift to talking about how you constructed the book and talk first a little about research, because this book is such a complex document of history and science and personal interviews. And I guess one place to start is whether or not, as we were talking about, some of the family members have been a bit closed. And I'm curious about how they accepted you into their world as an interviewer and how open they were with you and how perhaps you dealt with them if they weren't so open.
Well, you know, I mean, I think you always do your best in a piece like this, in a book like this. I mean, I think when I came to them, it just happened really by coincidence to be a period where they were looking for some attention and felt there would be that it would lead to some good for them. It was a time of I think considerable optimism in the prion field. You know, people really thought, well, maybe prions are going to, you know, they're going to give up their secrets and give them up quickly. And it was in the wake of Stanley Kuznets winning another Nobel Prize and so on and so forth. So, I mean, I think there was real hope. I don't know if there's quite as much hope right now, just because it turns out prions are just incredibly complicated and incredibly expensive to try and, you know, to work with. And I don't think anyone's quite solved that problem at this point, unfortunately. Mm. So I'm not sure that, you know, I think like many families with conditions, they kind of go in waves thinking about, you know, we should get attention, we should hide from attention. I mean, I think it's pretty typical.
Yeah. What's the state of things today? Has there been any progress since the book came out on changes or?
There's a lot of deep science progress. I don't think there's any kind of retail progress on it. I mean, that was one of the tricks about writing the book, was, you know, it's not a hopeless story because as you read it, you know, in every page there's hope. But at the same time, yeah, it's not a story with a happy ending yet.
Right.
Indeed, it may be 10 years, maybe 20 years, you know, you really can't know. I mean, that was a little bit of that was one of the tricks of writing the story was, well, you know, how do you keep a depressing story from being depressing? Well, I mean, my goal really was to infuse it with so much humanity that you didn't feel it was depressing. You felt it was what we are and who we are.
Right, right. Sort of a human triumph over, you know, disease and something we can't see and kind of how we deal with it on a day-to-day basis. And
yeah, how we remain human in spite of everything, I think, would be, you know, one of the themes of the book, although by no means, you know, the only thing that I was interested in. But I was certainly interested in that, and I cared about it a great deal.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I really lived to try and create a sense that in spite of everything, you know, they were still pushing forward, that they had very good lives. I mean, this is a funny thing. You know, this disease strikes in your late 50s, but, you know, you can do a lot of living by your late 50s. And these people don't spend every minute thinking about when they're going to get sick. You know, that's one of the other sort of points I tried to make in the book, was that it's more complicated than that. I mean, you know, everybody has an end waiting for them. So, you know, I mean, I wouldn't want theirs. But, you know, that said, you know, 55 great years and a great family and a great country, you know, that's not nothing.
That's not bad. Right, right. I'm curious about, you know, when you tackle a subject this big and this complex that has the history it has and kind of all the ripple effects that it has, when you know you have your arms kind of sufficiently around it and how you mine all the information out of it. Yeah,
well, my description was, it was like having an army in the field, like, you know, to really conquer a story that crossed three or four continents in 200 years and went from deep science to, you know, to what people were eating on their breakfast tables, to what was on the web and people saying they thought they had mad cow disease, you know, to the deep English history of the mad cow and the huge mad cow epidemic that struck England in the mid-90s, and then back to New Guinea where this prion disease called Kuru had affected a tribe who practiced cannibalism. I mean, it was like having an army in the field, but there was only me. You know, it was like the army had a general, and had a private, and it had a cook, and they were all one person. So it was insane. I mean, it was being stretched a million different ways. And, you know, you're trying to work under a reasonable deadline. You want to get your book out. You want people to read it. You know, you're not marrying the subject forever.
Right.
And that was a great stress. I mean, I really, you know, it took 5 years, and it easily could have taken more. I mean, there's no question it could have taken more. And I was working in part off, you know, I wasn't doing the original science. I wasn't spitting protein gels. You know, I was just recording the science. It was hard. You know, it was remarkable.
Now, how many places did you actually travel? I know you met with the Italian family.
Yeah, I was in Italy a great deal. I mean, I was in Italy a great deal. I was in England a fair amount. I never did go to Papua New Guinea, although I wanted to. Huh. But I had my first child at that time. A little boy was now five. And so, you know, it just was not going to be the right time to go. And you know, and then also, I mean, Papua New Guinea is now almost, I mean, it's really a hard place to travel in. Yeah. A lot of violence. I mean, the legacy of the colonial occupation that I write about has been very, very negative there. And so, you know, you have to say, like, that just was going to be an island too far. I mean, fundamentally and most deeply, this is about this family, about this insomnia, about, you know, about what it is to lose this most basic and cherished ability, which is to lie down at night and close your eyes. So I put my energy, if you know, to continue the metaphor of the army, like, you know, I put my troops overall in Italy and in Venice, where the story takes place, because I just thought this is really, you know, sort of rich. This is a terrific, tremendous oddity. You know, Venice, which if you read stories by Edgar Allan Poe, I mean, you can go back all through European literature, Venice, you know, in insomnia, the wake, you know, ghosts along the canals of Venice, and, you know, spirits haunting Venice, and ancient palazzi in Venice, you know, with their ghosts. I mean, that's so central. And then here was a real-life example of it. I mean, it was really, you know, it was just something you don't find every day.
Really compelling. Yeah, really compelling. And, you know, I also want to spend just a couple minutes talking about your ability to impart complicated scientific and biological information to lay readers, because this really was an accessible read. And when I encounter science, my brain just kind of turns off and I feel like I can't do it. But I didn't have the sense of that in this book. And so I'm curious.
Oh, thank you. I'm very pleased to hear that.
Yeah. No, you know, I typically, like I say, it's a scary thing, and you made it not scary. So you made a scary thing that's normally scary, not scary.
well, I mean, you know, I think what I tried to do was, as I learned, and I learned this a lot of this material for the book, I had a little sort of note to myself, which is a phrase I use, which is don't pull up the ladder. So in other words, you know, you climb up, and as you have a tendency, the writer, to sort of pull up the ladder so that it looks like you always knew this stuff. And so, you know, everyone else has to do the same work you did to get there. But that's really not very kind to the reader. I mean, you know, so if you had to learn the basic steps of proteins, you know, if you had to be reminded that a protein wasn't alive, if you had to be reminded that, you know, DNA has nucleic acid and be reminded what on earth nucleic acid is, I do that in the book. You know, I didn't cut out my learning process. I mean, it's not endless, but, you know, so I try always to give you the next rung on the ladder so you can get to what's, to me, to my mind, is what's really interesting. And that was, it's an absolute principle of mine in writing about science. And in fact, writing about everything, you know, I write these articles for The New Yorker. I did one recently on a chef who had cancer. And, you know, I was very careful to let you understand everything about what cancer is, because although we hear the word cancer 500 times a day, like, what is it, you know?
Right.
Is it a virus? Is it a protein? Is it some other thing? Is it an autoimmune disease? And what does that mean? You know, what is happening on the level of the cell? So I try and always do that, you know, and always be mindful, you know, really fundamentally that people relate to disease, I think, because it happens to people.
Right.
So there's always a person. It always stuns me. Part of a little bit of the book is about neurologists and how neurologists are absolutely, to my mind, and I've seen a lot of them, kind of the most, and I will already caveat this and say most neurologists just don't seem to notice that there's a patient inside that thinking, that remarkable machine, that, you know, that there's the ghost in the machine is a person.
Mm-hmm.
And so I work very hard to remind you that all disease occurs within people, or all human disease occurs within people, and not really within biological mechanisms or biological systems, which would be a more technical way to look at what goes on. You know, it's just, writing must always, to my mind, be about human. Now, there are people who write differently. I mean, there are people who write books on physics and there's not a soul in them, you know, and I admire that.
Yeah.
But I'm always drawn again and again, you know, what did it look like? What did it feel like? You know, what is it like to experience this? Even if you're a scientist, what is it like to look into a centrifugator and see a protein gel that's separated? You know, I mean, just things that you and I will never have the experience of doing.
Right.
I mean, again and again, when I research a book, I say, let me do it, you know?
Right.
Like, what do you want to look at? I'm like, well, I want to, you know? Let me describe it. This is what I do, you know? Your paper's terrific, professor, you know, and I almost got through it. But let me look. Let me see, you know. Let me feel it.
Yeah, and all the
5 pounds, there's nothing to feel. Of course, they're so small. But let me feel it, you know?
Right, right. And all those tactile details and the, I mean, just the details behind what happens to you when you have this fatal familial insomnia, all of those, you know, obviously lend themselves to a suspenseful read. But like I said earlier, the book encompasses so much more than that with the, you know, the mad cow and the crazy scientists and cannibalism, and the list sort of went on. And, I suppose as the research reveals itself to you, the subject matter spins itself out. But nevertheless, you know, weaving that into a fictive art and, you know, demanding to see the centrifuge and putting in all of those tactile details is really what brought this book to life. And I'm wondering if it was difficult to know what to leave in and perhaps what to leave out, or if, you know, kind of everything got put in.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is. It's a trick. You know, it is a book. It's not a very long book. It's about 220 pages, I think, if I remember, with some notes at the end to show you that it's actually accurate. And, it could be a 700-page book. I mean, you're really, you know, it's like that old newsreel, you know, spanning the globe. You know, it's like you're everywhere, and you're looking at different eras and different kinds of people. I mean, the beginning of the book is a recreation of what it was like in 18th-century Venice, as best I could. Like, what would it be like if you found out that you had a disease that no one could understand? And to modernize, we go, well, Venice, they probably understood nothing, but Venice at the time perceived itself as the cutting edge of medicine. It was sort of like getting sick, you know, near Sloan Kettering. I mean, it was, you know, they thought it was just the right place to be sick because medical knowledge was so advanced. You know, Padua, which was down the river, or down the canal, which is, you know, a major, you know, which was the best medical school in Europe, or probably one of the two best medical schools in Europe at the time. So had to capture that too, and that's a long way from looking at a protein gel, which is, you know, protein gels they bring up a lot. But anyway, that's how you would see whether someone had a prion disease. It's a, it's shorthand in my mind for the unknowable and the untellable in the world of science writing. You know, protein gel, it probably puts people to sleep just to hear the word.
Not after this book, I guarantee you.
Well,
not after
you.
This book. This is great. Do you have one sentence of writing advice for either essayists, nonfiction writers, or fiction writers?
Yeah, boy, you're putting me on the spot. Sentence of writing advice. You know, I mean, I think I would bring out the ancient, the hoary, and the bedraggled writing is rewriting, you know. Yeah. Well, I learned to be a writer when I learned to rewrite. I learned that it would not come out right the first time, and not to panic, and not to tear it up, and not to hit the delete button, you know. It was a palimpsest. You just lay layer after layer of your best thinking on, and eventually it becomes better.
That's all good advice. That's perfect. This has been a huge pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks. I'm glad. I enjoyed it myself.
Oh, that was D.T. Max. His latest book, The Family That Couldn't Sleep, is available now and published by Random House. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Sahira Alam will be with me when we return. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. I'll be right back.
To see you go, come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. We gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Talk it over. before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tsang, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
What is this profession called coaching? What is a coach? No, not football, not soccer, not even tennis. By now, you must have heard the terms life coaching or executive coaching or even business coaching. Come find out on Coaching Conversations with me, Patricia Hirsch, where I interview coaches from around the world, mainly from the 12,000-plus membership of the International Coach Federation, where coaches are becoming certified. Coaching Conversations with Patricia Hirsch, alternate Fridays at 9 a.m. on KUCI 88.9 FM Irvine. Find out more on the show's website at www.patriciahirsch.com. That's PatriciaHirsch.com.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit KUCI.org or KUCITalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at KUCI.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes, public radio page, or Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for more details on that. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I'm here now with Sahar Alam. Sahar was born in Lucknow, India, and moved to the United States when she was five. She's a graduate of Princeton University, where she majored in chemical engineering and the creative writing program at Boston University. She was a fiction fellow at Emory University, and her stories have appeared in Best of the Fiction Workshops and the journal Literary Imagination. Her debut novel, The Groom to Have Been, published by Spiegel & Grau, is available now and is the subject of our discussion this morning. Sahar, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Thanks for coming on. So I'm curious first about the chemical engineering background and how it led you to fiction.
it didn't quite lead me to fiction, but it was running in parallel to my interest in fiction writing. And when I was at school, I was sort of taking creative writing classes on the sly, but with great, great teachers. And but I didn't really believe that there was a path for me to become a writer. I didn't really aspire to be a writer when I was a kid. But I did take some fantastic classes, and I continued to sort of write for myself until a friend of mine went to graduate school to get an MFA, and I sort of realized that I could as well.
Oh, nice. So you gave up the chemical engineering completely at that point?
I did give it up, and I used to think that I had sort of lost it all, but one day I looked down in my notebooks and saw that as I was working on a story, I'd drawn a flow diagram, which is a box used to usually depict how a chemical changes as it passes through a process or a piece of equipment, and I had used that box to represent a scene. So in some ways, I think my training still lingers, and it sort of shapes the way I think and organize information.
That's interesting, because you've got both sides of the brain working so beautifully in harmony, and I love that. We are just coming off a science interview from our first half hour, so that's that kind of intrigued me there. So tell us about The Groom to Have Been, both the premise of the novel and the basis of your interest in writing it.
Yeah, well, the book is about a man from an Indian Muslim community, much like the communities that I know and have been a part of, who agrees to an arranged marriage, even though he could have ostensibly married for love. And the book is set in the summer and fall of 2001, a period during which, the differences between his family and his future in-laws' families were untrivialized, I think, by September 11th and the issues that were raised and the questions of loyalty that were stirred up at that time in our communities.
Yeah. The one thing that was interesting and really well done was that the revelation of the story's end, or at least the kind of the principal problem of the novel, was revealed early on. You know, we knew the issue, we knew who he was kind of set to marry, and then it was a matter of working backward and forward in time to see the resolution over this sort of six-month-ish period. And I'm curious if you can talk about constructing the novel, sort of putting together the architecture of how it would work on the page.
Yeah, well, actually, the novel began as a short story, and it was a short story for quite a while, maybe a year and a half, and then it was a long story, and then it was a novella, and then I thought I was writing a short novel. And it sort of grew on me organically, and for a long period of time, I thought this was great. This was a sort of natural way to move from writing short stories to writing novels. But the structure of the original short story, in which, because of the limited space, I could sort of go back and forth in time, eventually became a bit restrictive on the novel. Mm. And it lingered a while longer than it probably was useful to me, and I had to break free from it. But I did like the idea of continuing to straddle the main problem in Nesser's life from both its as he approaches it and as he moves away from it, because he sort of keeps going back and forth between these two cultures and between his ideas and attitudes towards them.
Yeah, that's interesting. At what point did you realize that this was no longer a short story? Was there something that happened plot-wise or something that happened character-wise that made you realize that the short story form was too limiting on what was happening?
Yeah. Well, I think it was the way the story came to me was that I had the title, the first line, and the ending, and I spent much of my time filling it in. And I think what became evident was that the filling in was carrying so much. It was getting so much longer than it was initially. That the ending made less and less sense. And so. So I was sort of having to backtrack, backpedal, and fill out connections along the way. And I think that's when the ending didn't fit what I'd written, I think that's when I realized it wasn't a short story.
It wasn't a short story. Yeah, that's interesting to know the ending of a piece when you begin. Did you have sort of it sounds like you couldn't have had an outline in your mind because everything was expanding so much, but knowing the ending remained a static thing throughout, and the ending really was the ending when you came to the end?
The ending, it did stay as I had originally conceived it, but the path to the ending obviously just kept sort of changing. Mm-hmm. And I didn't work from an outline, but as I say, I did have these flow diagrams, and I'm a very visual person, so I did find myself constantly finding a new path through these scenes that I had set up. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That makes sense. And the other thing I want to talk about is kind of how you excavated these characters, because each of these characters were so distinctive. They really came alive on the page, and they felt fully fleshed out. And I'm wondering if there was a lot of work that went on maybe off the page to bring these people to life for yourself, and kind of how you mined who these people were, and if you did it kind of through the process of writing the book, or if there were, you know, things done kind of offline to get to know who these people were.
A lot of it was done through the writing process, but the book has this connection to The Age of Innocence, which is a book I love, and so I feel like I leaned on its characterization a bit in initiating my investigation into these characters. And I also feel like writing about my parents' generation, it's not historical fiction, but it does feel like fiction that requires me to do some sort of, if not formal research, but then investigation into their lives and their expectations for people of my generation. So there was that kind of research, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly it was just getting into the knots of the novel and trying to figure out who these people are from the situations that they found themselves in. So sort of working back from the quandaries that they were in.
Right, right. That makes sense. Yeah, and I wanted to talk about Edith Wharton because your work is obviously very influenced by her. She appears briefly as sort of a figure in the novel, and the book opens with a passage taken from The Age of Innocence. Talk about your interest in her work and how she sort of inspired parts of the novel for you.
Well, you know, there are so many reasons to love her work, and what I was particularly drawn to was, in addition to the sort of clear-eyed observations that she makes about people and their social relations and the sort of ability she has to make a reader really feel sympathy and pity toward a character who's sort of cowardly, actually, in The Age of Innocence, is that she seems to, in one sweep, capture the social relations that were shifting and starting to unravel, and this felt like it corresponded well to the, at least for me, the immigrant experience, when you're sort of on shifting ground, you know, almost your entire life. You're not quite sure where you're at with people, and with people you know and with people you don't know. So her, the period in society in which she's writing about seemed to correspond and seemed with my experience and seemed really familiar to me. And also the emphasis and urgency that choosing a spouse took on at that time in society and what it meant to choose well and wisely seemed to carry the same weight that it carries among, you know, the communities that I know.
Yeah, interesting. I like that. I also want to give you a chance to read to us a bit and kind of welcome our listeners into this world, because it's really, after you read, I want to talk about your language and how you work with words.
Okay.
Can you read to us just a little bit?
Sure, thank you. This is an excerpt from the second chapter of the book.
Perfect. I'll remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Silher Alam, and she is going to read from her latest book, The Groom to Have Been.
Everybody knew that arranged marriages were for desperate people. Old maidy, overeducated, semi-Western girls who weren't pretty enough or meek enough to attract men on their own, and straight from India guys who had adolescent expectations and weren't patient enough or suave enough or were altogether forbidden by their mothers to date. Nesser wasn't desperate, and this, he thought, when he finally agreed to let his mother find him a bride, would be his chief tactical advantage. The search for this bride began in earnest on Nesser's next trip back to Montreal. He, his mother, and his younger sister, Yasmin, who was essential to the process because she could communicate with their mother more efficiently, swept the local counties. They went to awkward teas hosted by nervous parents, sat in spacious, empty living rooms as well as cramped and steamy ones, pretending that the questions being asked were merely sociable. Your family is from which region? Ah, yes, and before that they were, and how long have you been away? Every so often, Hamid Uncle and his wife, Dalathanti, would come along on these visits, lending the occasion old-world formality. Even when the two of them didn't attend the meetings, they were almost always present for the lengthy discussions that followed, in which the merits of the latest prospect were debated. Sometimes these discussions spilled into the informal dinner parties Nesser's mother or Dalathanti hosted when he was home visiting, and they also, Nesser suspected, went on when he wasn't around. For if his mother was on the lookout, all her friends, an entire network of aunties, would also feel charged with the task. When he was part of the debates, Nesser found that he didn't mind having other people in the room. It allowed him to say what he couldn't say to his mother when they were alone. Too young, too religious, too dependent, too quiet, too dowdy, too brainy, too ditzy, too bassy, too Pakistani, too modern, too American. To be fair, he often invited others to air their impressions. Yes, yes, to wear a skirt on such an occasion does show bad judgment, after all. This was his mother. Well, it's the quality of the family that is not what it could be, Hamid Uncle. I didn't like her brother, a total Fabio, Yasmin. Nesser was well aware that his mother wanted a certain kind of daughter-in-law, and that although it had taken him a while to realize it, some of her requirements actually matched what he had in mind for a wife. because Sunni Muslim girls from good families who spoke enough Urdu to teach it to their children didn't exactly hang out in bars, he was agreeing to an arranged marriage, yes. But his consent was not without certain conditions. Marriage to him would not mean what it meant to those bozos who came from abroad, expecting fresh chapatis for dinner every night, and who got nervous when the conversation turned to anything other than their work, their nostalgia, or the latest episode of ER. He didn't want an unassertive woman, just the opposite, in fact.
That's great. That was Sahir Alam reading from her book, The Groom to Have Been. One of the things that was really striking about this is how much Nasir was forced to sort of explain and not justify, but to explain his life to the Western world and sort of living an Eastern life in a Western world. At least a lot of, you know, kind of tedious, I don't know if he felt it was tedious, kind of, you know, explanations of what the wedding was going to be like and what the expectations were. I'm wondering if you find that the Western world is, you know, kind of either particularly closed or judgmental of Eastern philosophy or simply very naive, or if it does feel like sort of a tedious explanation of culture.
I think there are sort of aspects of all cultures that are hidden from other cultures. And while weddings are very public events, I think the emotions that are particularly attached to different events within weddings can be sort of closed off in a way that's entirely to be expected from people who aren't involved. And so I think that the sharing that Nasser is forced to do is both a sign of interest and maybe also a little bit of ignorance. But I think it's a demand that is placed on him in exchange for the privileges that he enjoys, you know, as a person who straddles these cultures and can move between them. So I think there is, a trade that he has to make, and this is part of the payment. Although he doesn't always feel this way.
right. And I'm also wondering if there are aspects of the Indian culture that have been difficult for you to translate as a writer to American readers, if that was a challenge, and how you don't, you know, you never fall into sort of an explanatory kind of, you know, educational or some sort of non-fictive mode. You maintain the fictive dream while also bringing us into this culture. Is that a difficult thing to do?
Oh, thank you. I think all writers hope to bring something new to readers, whether it's new information or new takes on older information or new methods for delivering information. So in that sense, I guess I am sort of thinking about what would be new to my readers. But I'm relieved to hear that the book doesn't sound educational in any way. There are some things that I have tried to contextualize enough so that the meaning is clear. But I also recognize, and I think that even when I read things that aren't from grounded in the background of my experience, I will miss some some allusions. And I think if I'm interested in them, I go off and pursue the meaning of these mysteries to me. And if I'm not, then I sort of have to accept that, I make the sense that I can of them as I read along. A cousin of mine, recently read the book, and she was asking why I hadn't included, or if I had thought about including a glossary for the foreign terms, and I had thought a bit about it, but I decided against it because, first of all, there are so many foreign terms, but they are pretty, they're not foreign to my characters who live in these two different languages and two different worlds pretty fluently. So I didn't want to attract unreasonable attention to them, and I also didn't want to make readers feel as though they were having to turn to the back of the book and reference something as they would in a textbook or something.
Yeah, I agreed with that decision, and I was interested in asking you about that as well. And that was my experience, was that I was really able to just kind of meld in with this world, and the words were contextual enough where, you know, I could generally figure it out. And if I really couldn't, I could have gone to look it up, but you're right. It never, I think that was one of the ways in which you really maintained the fictive dream in this, was to really immerse us in the culture and in the language without without making, I would have kind of felt compelled to jump to the back of the book, which would have necessarily pulled me out, you know. So I thought that was a great decision. And, you know, one of the things I mentioned earlier, and it was another really striking thing about this novel for me, was the beauty of the language itself, the quality of the observations, the depiction of the images. It was very easy to get lost in the rhythm and beauty of the words. Do you immerse yourself, I know you were very influenced by Edith Wharton, but do you immerse yourself in poetry or other works of fiction when you're writing, or do you find it kind of necessary to sort of void out external influences to develop your own voice?
I definitely lean on my reading, and I generally return to writers that I love, including a writer that everybody loves, Alice Munro. But I do find myself reading stuff that is very different from my work, and maybe that helps me pay attention to the sentences in some way that I wouldn't if I was sort of familiar with the material. But I do like to read while I write. Of course, there are times when it feels as though, you know, an influence is getting too close, and you sort of need to concentrate on your character. So I take breaks by reading other things. I sort of read nonfiction and articles and things.
Chemical engineering books.
That's one thing I don't read anymore.
And the last big topic, which you should never save for the end, but one of the things that this also did so well was to really put a lot of words to my thoughts and observations about September 11th. September 11th is obviously when the book is set and plays an enormous role. And this kind of opens up a twofold thing for me, and as we're running out of time, it's probably not the best thing, but... but this kind of bifurcated sets of emotions that Muslims must experience in the wake of this event. You gave language to a real cross-section of complicated emotions. And I'm wondering if there is a real division of emotions in thinking about this, not only within Indian Muslim communities, but within families and the lasting impact of this on communities in the U.S. and Canada.
Yeah, I mean, I think so, and I kind of hope so. One of the questions people ask me is, why is this book set in Canada? And there are many reasons for that, but I felt like that one layer of remove, with Canadians being able to say in perfect sympathy, the terrorists attack them, corresponds psychically to the immigrant experience of being both among and inside, and of being able to think they attack them. But for, of course, Muslims, it becomes a little complicated, or a lot complicated, because you then also can think, well, we attack them. And then for immigrants, it becomes even stranger, because you can think, we attacked us. It feels as though, yes, the sort of differences that events like weddings untrivialize between immigrants who have, say, grown all from India and all from the same place, who have grown up in suburban Cleveland versus urban New York, a wedding might untrivialize them and say that we are all the same because we are all from the same place and we're all of the same religion. But in fact, these differences are important, and they do get stirred up and meaningful in other contexts. So September 11th was, in a way, a really sort of awful time to reconnect to have this desire, as Nesser does, to reconnect to your background. And I think that the push and pull on him and Jamila, and then the radicalization of Jamila in the novel, is one of the sort of terrible sort of after effects of something like this, that you can have people in communities who are turned in directions that they would have never headed toward.
Yeah.
If this hadn't happened.
Yeah, it was just, you know, I know that's a complicated subject to write about, and you really gave, like I say, you gave words to an incredibly complex and emotionally, you know, mucky situation so well. Do you have any, sadly we're running out of time, but do you have any last words of advice, wisdom for writers?
Oh, Oh, well, the kindest thing, kind of piece of advice I ever received was to remember that when writing is hardest, when it's not coming and you're banging your head against a proverbial wall, is that that's when you might be on the verge of a breakthrough, and that when you're doing something, and you might be doing something you've never done and don't yet know how to do, but it could be very thrilling if you just hang on.
Ooh, I like that. That's good advice. Sahara, this was a huge pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. It was a thrill to be on the show.
That was Sahara Alam, author of The Groom to Have Been, available now and published by Spiegel and Grau. I took a little analogy from Mark Twain this morning. The difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning and the lightning bug. I'm taking the rest of this month off, but Barbara will be back with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.